Part 3, Chapter 26. For 3 years, Morris had been so fit and happy that he went on automatically for a day longer. He woke with the feeling that it must be all right soon. Clive would come back, apologizing or not, as he chose, and he would apologize to Clive. Clive must love him, because his whole life was dependent on love, and here it was, going on as usual. How could he sleep and rest if he had no friend? When he returned from town to find no news, he remained for a little calm, and allowed his family to speculate on Clive's departure. But he began to watch Ada. She looked sad. Even their mother noticed it. Shading his eyes, he watched her. Save for her, he would have dismissed the scene as one of Clive's long speeches, but she came into that speech as an example. He wondered why she was sad. "I say," he called when they were alone. He had no idea what he was going to say, though a sudden blackness should have warned him. She replied, but he could not hear her voice.
"What's wrong with you?" he asked, trembling.
"Nothing."
"There is, I can see it. You can't take me in."
"Oh, no, really, Morris, nothing."
What did he say?"
"Nothing."
"Who said nothing?"
he yelled, crashing both fists on the table. He had caught her.
"Nothing, only Clive."
The name on her lips opened hell. He suffered hideously, and before he could stop himself had spoken words that neither ever forgot. He accused his sister of corrupting his friend. He let her suppose that Clive had complained of her conduct and gone back to town on that account. Her gentle nature was so outraged that she could not defend herself, but sobbed and sobbed, and implored him not to speak to her mother, just as if she were guilty. He assented. Jealousy had maddened him.
"But when you see him, Mr. Durham, tell him I didn't mean... Say there's no one whom I'd rather..."
"Go wrong with," he supplied. Not till later did he understand his own blackguardism. Hiding her face, Ada collapsed.
"I shall not tell him. I shall never see Durham again to tell. You've the satisfaction of breaking up that friendship," she sobbed.
"I don't mind that. You've always been so unkind to us, always."
He drew up at last. Kitty had said that sort of thing to him, but never Ada. He saw that beneath their obsequious surface his sisters disliked him. He had not even succeeded at home. Muttering, "It's not my fault," he left her. A refined nature would have behaved better and perhaps have suffered less. Morris was not intellectual, nor religious, nor had he that strange solace of self-pity that is granted to some. Except on one point, his temperament was normal, and he behaved as would the average man who, after 2 years of happiness, had been betrayed by his wife. It was nothing to him that nature had caught up this dropped stitch in order to continue her pattern. While he had love, he had kept reason. Now he saw Clive's change as treachery, and Ada as its cause, and returned in a few hours to the abyss where he had wandered as a boy. After this explosion, his career went forward. He caught the usual train to town to earn and spend money in the old manner. He read the old papers and discussed strikes and the divorce laws with his friends. At first he was proud of his self-control. Did not he hold Clive's reputation in the hollow of his hand? But he grew more bitter. He wished that he had shouted while he had the strength and smashed down this front of lies. What if he too were involved? His family, his position in society... There had been nothing to him for years. He was an outlaw in disguise. Perhaps among those who took to the greenwood in old time, there had been two men like himself. Two. At times he entertained the dream, two men can defy the world. Yes, the heart of his agony would be loneliness. He took time to realize this, being slow. The incestuous jealousy, the mortification, the rage at his past obtuseness, these might pass, and having done much harm, they did pass. Memories of Clive might pass, but the loneliness remained. He would wake and gasp, "I've no one," or, "Oh, Christ, what a world!" Clive took to visiting him in dreams. He knew there was no one, but Clive, smiling in his sweet way, said, "I'm genuine this time," to torture him. Once he had a dream about the dream of the face and the voice. A dream about it, no nearer. Also, old dreams of the other sort that tried to disintegrate him. Days followed nights. An immense silence, as of death, encircled the young man, and as he was going up to town one morning, it struck him that he really was dead. What was the use of money grubbing, eating and playing games? That was all he did, or had ever done. "Life's a damn poor show," he exclaimed, crumpling up the Daily Telegraph. The other occupants of the carriage who liked him began to laugh. "I'd jump out of the window for tuppence." Having spoken, he began to contemplate suicide. There was nothing to deter him. He had no initial fear of death, and no sense of a world beyond it, nor did he mind disgracing his family. He knew that loneliness was poisoning him, so that he grew viler as well as more unhappy. Under these circumstances, might he not cease? He began to compare ways and means, and would have shot himself but for an unexpected event. The event was the illness and death of his grandfather, which induced a new state of mind. Meanwhile, he had received letters from Clive, but they always contained the sentence, "We had better not meet just yet." He grasped the situation now. His friend would do anything for him except be with him. It had been thus ever since the first illness, and on these lines he was offered friendship in the future. Morris did not cease to love, but his heart had been broken. He never had wild thoughts of winning Clive back. What he grasped with a firmness that the refined might envy and suffered up to the hilt. He answered these letters, oddly sincere. He still wrote what was true, and confided that he was unbearably lonely and should blow out his brains before the year ended. But he wrote without emotion. It was more a tribute to their heroic past, and accepted by Durham as such. His replies were unemotional also, and it was plain that however much help he was given, and however hard he tried, he could no longer penetrate into Morris's mind.